listening to CPR, communitypublicradio.org. And this is Weekday World. I'm your host, Don DeBar. With a report of some of the news and events of the past 24 hours from the CPR Newsroom. From Community Public Radio, this is the CPR News. From New York, I'm Don DeBar. This Friday, two big items in the news here in the United States were the Skripal case, the poisoning case in the UK, and what appears to be a burgeoning trade war between the US and China. For more on that, we spoke with international affairs analyst Mark Sloboda, who's a senior lecturer at Moscow State University, via Skype from Moscow on Friday. Okay, Mark, well, let's see. We've got the Skripal case. We've got Trump and Xi thumping on each other's chests about various tariffs and things and a whole lot more. So let's just dive in.
Well, thanks for having me, Don. It's always good to be on the CPR. Always an honor and a pleasure.
Our pleasure to have you.
I think probably the latest news out of this Sergei Skripal political theater that's being waged. First, the news out today was that Sergei Skripal is no longer in critical condition.
So that's some fatal chemical weapon, huh? It didn't kill either one of them.
Three of them.
Oh, right, that's right.
Because there was the policeman. He's already out walking along the streets for a couple months now. A couple weeks now. The daughter miraculously recovered just over a week ago.
Yeah, she did an interview yesterday or something.
Yeah, she did a phone. Yeah, she called her relatives in Russia. And she says she's fine and her father is fine and sleeping. That there was no irreversible harm done. And that they expect to be released soon. And Sergei Skripal, it was announced today that he is no longer in critical condition. He's recovering, in what must be presumed a stable condition. Now, this is a miraculous Easter miracle. We must assume that this is evidence of the second coming of Jesus Christ, because we've been told for some 6 weeks now that this is a military grade secret Soviet nerve agent 10 times more powerful than VX. We've been told that it would leave them brain dead, that if they weren't dead yet, their lungs and heart, their entire nervous system would be destroyed, and their lungs and heart wouldn't work on their own, and that if they took them off the machines, they would die and they would be brain dead regardless. And in fact, it's rather amusing that in the last week, the Telegraph ran a story with a headline along the lines that the Skripals should be allowed to die, friends say. And then the very next day, 36 hours later, they ran a headline that the daughter, Yulia Skripal, is okay. She's out of critical condition, and she's talking and responsive and everything. So, I don't know what else to tell you. This is probably enough to make me convert.
Well, it is Orthodox Easter coming up Sunday, so.
And you guys had Easter last week.
That's right. Yep, he did. Yep.
So, on top of that, the latest news out as this is going on is that the U.S. State Department has leveled new sanctions against Russia, or at least against a handful of Russian businessmen, oligarchs, and Russian companies. And the statement from the State Department was that this was not directly related to the Skripal scenario, the narrative which is falling apart minute by minute, but is concerning Russia's malign activities around the world for the last few years, which basically I translate as these bad boys have been resisting our regime change Syria and Ukraine.
That's so right. These elites will no longer be insulated from consequences of Russia's destabilizing activities. Now, how do you call what Russia is doing in Syria destabilizing from the White House?
Well, they're literally destabilizing Al Qaeda and our
right. But you have the U.S. and its allies throwing all these terrorists into Syria to destabilize and then destroy the country. The government invites Russia in to stabilize the country and protect it from these destabilizing elements, and yet Russia's destabilizing.
As Josh Rogan said in the pages of the Washington Post last week in a headline, we took the oil. And then he finished it with the line, "We took the oil, now we have to keep it."
Nice. At least they're honest.
That's what I find refreshing about Josh Rogan is for a neocon imperialist, he's one of the more honest and forthright ones. He doesn't need to cloak everything behind democratizing rhetoric and so on. So,
well, you got Heather Nauert yesterday, by the way. I'm looking at the Department of State. The United States calls on, of all people, Vietnam to release all prisoners of conscience immediately and to allow all individuals in Vietnam to express their views freely and assemble peacefully without fear of retribution. Or does that mean also without fear of a B-52 attack or the Agent Orange attack? How did the United States dare to talk about what goes on inside Vietnam at this point?
Well, I mean, Heather Nauert last week, I mean, she is directly quoted as saying, this is the U.S. State Department spokeswoman, that Russia has many arms and many tentacles. It is a deep sea
beast,
quote unquote. I had no idea that Heather Nauert was a Cthulhu fan, was an H.P. Lovecraft fan.
Yeah, right.
And so I only have one thing to say to Heather. Fanaglui Mlugli na Cthulhu Ryla Waga Naga Futagin.
Which means?
In his house at Ryla, dead Cthulhu waits dreaming.
What is that from? Is that from
H.P. Lovecraft.
Oh, same thing. There you go.
Yeah, okay. Cthulhu, the tentacles. The tentacles.
There you go. So I was thinking more like it was like a fried galamad or something that they had in mind.
I mean, you can go back to the Russian Empire. Of which there were numerous iterations. The early days of the Soviet Union, Goebbels' propaganda against the Soviet Union during World War II, all through the Cold War, and this thing with octopus and tentacles, this refrain has been repeated all the way throughout, all the way up to the most modern.
Yep.
You know, in the last couple of weeks, The Economist picturing Putin as the meddler, as a octopus with Putin's face, and now Heather Nauert's Cthulian tentacles. You know, I mean, it's amazing. You know, a couple weeks ago, The Guardian literally just copied a many-armed tentacle, a piece of literal Goebbels propaganda, and just updated for the first day. You can find it online. It's
like that now, though. It really is like that.
It is amazing how crude it is, though, in a way. Like how little innovation there is to it when you've been looking at when you've been dealt with the same type of propaganda for the last 150 years. I guess the whole thing behind it is showing is Russia's influence and meddling throughout the world. I mean, and this is coming from the U.S. and U.K. Are you serious?
Yeah, right. I know. Please.
Them calling someone else meddling?
I'm wondering, meanwhile, is Heather Nauert reaching anything the popularity of our dear friend from the Obama administration?
Oh. Psaki?
Yeah, Jen Psaki.
Psaki, yeah. Now, Jen Psaki has legendary status here. Russian people, I mean, she was a piece of you know, the nighttime, late night TV shows.
Right.
She was a regular.
Right.
You know, her skits. You know, she was the Russian's favorite comedy routine out of the United States, and Heather Nauert is definitely she's showing her, you know, some oomph. She's putting it all out there, but she's got a long way to go to fill Psaki's shoes.
Yep. That's well, she's working on it, though. She's working pretty hard.
She's working. Give her credit. Give her credit. I think she's got potential.
All right. So meanwhile, The real story here, and watching the international markets rebound over the, you know, back and forth over the last few days, what the media portrays as a trade war with China, the U.S. and China, in other words, then they're personalizing it, of course, between Trump and Xi. Who knows what's going on in the back rooms, because there are certainly some actual adjustments that have to be made, and some of those in the face of some well-established constituencies in both places. So there's got to be kind of a, you know, an apparent game and then the actual game. But you have Trump imposing tariffs on steel and aluminum, I think, initially, and China standing up to that. The market's going haywire, thinking there's a trade war in the offing. Then they stabilize, then another chest-thumping session, and another just today. So maybe you want to work some of that.
Sure. First of all, I do find it rather interesting. Almost as one, the Western media, popular, you know, powerful figures in Washington, even the American Chamber of Commerce has been almost universal in condemning this trade war on China by Trump, which is all rather fascinating,
right?
Because, well, we are one thin straw away from an actual hot war with nuclear-armed Russia.
Right.
God forbid that we have a trade war that interferes with business.
That's
because
right.
Because that's another story. Well, the way Trump tells it, and you know, and he does tell it right on Twitter and elsewhere, that the U.S. He says the U.S. is not at a trade war with Russia, because which is ridiculous, because obviously there are. He's just escalating it because the U.S. lost a trade war with China due to the foolish and incompetent policies for the last couple decades.
Right.
And he's actually got a point there.
Yeah, no kidding.
I mean, it goes a little bit further back. It goes all the way back to Bretton Woods and the creation of the neoliberal capitalist system,
right,
the embrace of China during the Cold War, and the flowing of Western capital into China for, you know, cheap production value.
Yep.
It is an inevitable and predictable result of the process.
Yep, I know.
What they hoped that is that in the midst of all of this, that the Chinese Communist government, which is economically communist and really in name only, would collapse throughout this process. And they haven't. In fact, they've managed. They studied how the Soviet Union collapsed, and they've kept control rather well.
Right.
Now, certainly with a large amount of social benefits that has to be recognized, certainly that Americans last, but also with a great deal of political and societal control,
right.
And themselves at the head of it. So, these numbers are contested, but the official figures is the U.S. has a $500 billion trade deficit with China. And this is, longstanding.
Right. Which is about $1,500, $1,300 for every man, woman, and child in the United States. I mean, it's a chunk of change for sure.
Yeah. And that comes on top of a $21 billion U.S. just federal deficit,
right,
of which the largest foreign holder of that debt
is China,
to a tune of almost $2 trillion in total, is China.
Right.
So, picking a trade war with your primary foreign debtor,
right,
not the smartest thing. Not the smartest thing in the world.
It's like going down the street to the bank to see the president of the bank that holds a mortgage on your house, punching him in the face, and then defaulting on your loan.
So now this $500 billion, there are people who are trying to contest it, who say, well, it doesn't include services, which the U.S. does a good business with services with China. Of course, they are already doing the same back, and that it doesn't account for parts that are actually high tech parts, chips and stuff that are actually come from some other countries, Japan and South Korea, and then are just assembled in China, a lot of the end result profit does end up in China regardless.
Right.
Everyone knows there's a trade deficit.
Right.
The U.S. doesn't make anything anymore. Everything's made in China or Indonesia or so where, and Trump won election in no small part due to speaking to those who have been disenfranchised.
Right.
From this neoliberal capitalist globalization.
Right.
And when the economists and the supporters of it say that, GDP has gone up, they cherry pick a bunch of other numbers, and it's true. It's all true, right?
Yep.
Aggregate wealth has increased. It's gone to the hands of a few, but
right.
There's no question that aggregate wealth has GDP has gone up as a result of globalization, not just in the U.S., but in many other countries, China in particular as well.
Yep.
But what they never will admit to is that there have been those, and there is no small number of them, that have lost from globalization.
The majority in the United States. I mean, they poll that something like 65% of the population does not have $1,000 liquid.
Yeah. There's no question that living standards have gone down in the U.S., that the middle class is shrinking, and that particularly these blue-collar working-class jobs across the Mid-Atlantic and the Rust Belt were lost.
Right.
Now, the proponents of this globalization and free trade, Clinton, having been married to Bill Clinton, who was one of the biggest ones who saw this come to its peak, she can't really admit to any of this, Trump spoke to these people, and he spoke to their pain and suffering, and he said he would bring this fight to Washington. Now, of course, he can't do anything to change this. This is a genie or an efreet, a demon, however you want to look at it, that's been let out of the bottle.
Right.
And there's really no easy way to see how any of this can be clawed back, bar gigantic civilization collapsing, civil wars, and so on. The elite, the 1% that have been enriched throughout all of this, are not exactly going to give up the process that has made them so wealthy, and so on.
Yeah, you have to take their capital against their will, more or less, either in title or at least in operation, and apply it to constructing new factories and all. You have to build a new economy from the ground up with money that belongs to somebody else.
A new global economy, because it has to be remembered.
Right. Right. Where am I going to sell the cars?
Americans maintain what living standard they do due to the import of cheap Chinese and other Asian goods.
That's right.
Right. At extremely low prices.
Right.
That, you know, help maintain the illusion of prosperity on a global, relative comparison. And China needs the U.S. to continue purchasing to maintain its domestic growth, its employment, and so on. And other countries need China producing, like Russia, which is a huge supplier of energy and raw materials to China, as many other countries are, Iran and lots of Africa and so on. So we're all connected for better or worse these days, right? And this trade war is going to have reverberations, not just in the United States and not just in China, throughout the whole world. But Trump promised these American working class, and I'm looking specifically at you, Pennsylvania, Michigan, and Washington, that he would take
Ohio,
the fight for. I think in their heart of hearts, a lot of these people understand at some level that Trump is not going to be able to do anything to really improve their lives. The type of working class jobs that they've gone, that they had, are gone. They're never going to return to the United States. And Trump browbeating one company after another individually makes for great television, but it's not going to make jobs in any meaningful way to return to the United States. Same thing with this trade war here. Right. This is not actually a trade war with China. Yeah, sure, the U.S. has grievances with China. They say currency manipulator. They talk about dumping on the U.S. and other markets and everything. But they know that these tariffs being placed on Chinese good up to $50 billion. Now, just in the latest round, they're now talking. Trump is tweeting madly about another $100 billion or so. They know that this isn't going to shrink that trade deficit, right? To do that, Americans would have to stop buying cheap Chinese goods, and that's not going to happen. But this is all domestic political theater, and the Chinese are just guest actors in this. The real target is the midterm elections in 2018. And Trump needs to bring to the people that helped put him over the top in these states and in other states, he needs to show them that he's fighting for them, and this is his way of doing that. And it has to be noted, first of all, that these tariffs don't come into effect immediately. First of all, they've got a 2-month period for consultations, and then he's got another 6 months on top of that to implement them. So amazingly, that brings us right up to the midterm elections. Isn't that a coincidence? So China knows this. So I think what Trump wants is this political theater to show the people of the U.S. that he's fighting for them, and again, particularly these economically disenfranchised working class that are now shrinking from the middle class down into the lower class. And in some way, you can commiserate with him, at least in the fact that he's the only one who really spoke to their pain. It long ago became anathema in the Democratic Party to speak to the working poor.
Except for Sanders did too, which explains exactly his phenomenology.
It was rigged against him.
So. But he was supposed to be like a little blip that was going to be a straw person or a coat for her to wear, and instead, many say he actually beat her, but he rode that same sentiment and spoke to those same issues.
Sure, and he was slurred as a populist and a Russian puppet, and that, everything, as a Kremlin agent, as a result of that.
Yep.
So the Chinese have got to understand. I think they're smart enough to understand what's going on at this point, because if you take a look at their counter sanctions, and they of course immediately put a tariff on $50 billion of U.S. goods, it's focused heavily on agriculture. Particularly looking at soybeans, wheat, and other things.
Right.
Also at beef, whiskey, cigars, and if you take a look,
the states,
awful lot. Yeah, exactly.
It's an electoral
awful lot
map.
Of these products. Are red state products.
Yep.
And I think they're sending a signal to Trump saying, in the way they do, because, the Chinese can't compete with the Trump political theater via Twitter and, you know, him playing, you know, the liberal media in the U.S. like a fiddle, which he does so well. The Chinese, you know, don't do that. They take the phrase diplomatic understatement to a ridiculous level. But I think they're sending a signal in the way they can to Trump that they know that this is not actually about economics, that this is actually about domestic politics in the U.S. Yep. And by targeting these particular products in these states, which are, you know, you don't think of soybeans. Soybeans are actually a really important U.S. export. They're really important for the basis of a lot of other agriculture, for feedstocks and you know, tofu and other things. They're actually a fairly important product, and again, hitting these signature items: whiskey, cigars, you know, prime beef. You know, this is red state stuff.
Right.
This is red state stuff.
No, this is a surgical. You know, this is a political surgical. You know, response that from China.
Yeah, it is
saying,
really, and it's really interesting because the U.S.'s tariffs go all across the board to your right. Uranium and some tech and cars and the whereas on the other hand the Chinese sanctions are really laser focused. The U.S. right. sanctioned right. some 1,300 U.S. goods, I believe, something like that, or mm-hmm. Chinese goods.
Right.
They put tariffs on them, and the U.S. the Chinese sanctions back target 106. U.S. exports.
Now, see, I'm
going
to suggest also. I mean, this is something when we were doing the, you know, post-election review back in 2016 that I had noted. You know, having followed Trump's development career, that their ground game dealt with micro constituencies. You know, like in laser precision, they, you know, would map a community. They knew who everybody was, what everybody wanted, what they had to say to get their projects approved. And even though they were way out
thanks
of scale,
Cambridge Analytica.
Okay, but even
and
before
Facebook,
that, but even before that, and that's how they roll. And so what China's doing is saying, not only do we know your game, you know, we can play it. You can say all that stuff if you want. If it starts to get real, we know exactly where to take you out. It's like they're mapping his groin right before they kick, you know. And it's an interesting. Let me just ask you, because we got about 5 minutes left. But you know, this is the apparent game. This is what I was referring to earlier. You have Trump is playing to his political constituencies for the midterms and also to solidify his position. You know, because he's still under constant attack from all over the place here. China has that issue and also to assert itself in the real world as a response. The actual global economy, in a way, you know, the way that the U.S. Subsidizes the working class with cheap Chinese labor here is essentially a variant of the old imperialist model. They used to do this on, you know, cheap materials and labor from third world colonies. And now there's this whole weird hybrid that was constructed over the last 30 years, while it also enabled China to rapidly develop itself. And China's relationship is like a classic capitalist model. They look at the United States as a big market that they have to keep and add to. How are they going to... there's some kind of an, I don't know if it's epical, but some kind of sea change in international relations keeps trying to, you know, present itself on the stage. We had this, you know, head-on resistance by the hegemonic characters during the Obama administration. I think Clinton represented that. Do you think that there's like a new deal trying to be negotiated in the back room and that this bluster might be cover for it?
Yeah, I don't see any, certainly no deal between the U.S. and China or anything. I mean, I think it's nothing being done between these two sides. But there definitely is a multipolar world emerging, and the U.S. is still doing its best to cling on to the, you know, the power and the levers that they have. China knows this. They know that they and the rest of the world economy depends on this fiction of U.S. consumption on massive debt and so on. They're playing the game, and one of the things that has been noted in this whole thing is that Chinese domestic consumption is increasing. Right?
Yeah,
they've elevated the wealth of their own people to a significant degree where they're able to buy their own products in other countries, and this is a measure of defense against U.S. tariffs. They can absorb some of that. They're not as vulnerable as they were 10 years ago, and they're becoming less so. One of the big things that China can play is they've slowly been reducing the amount of U.S. debt, U.S. dollars that they buy, and they could start selling them off. And that's going to happen eventually. China's not ready yet. They will be. Russia's doing the same thing, heavily investing in gold, which the Chinese have also been doing for their reserves,
right.
And there have been the basic architecture built to trade in each other's currency for things like oil and stuff. To fight the petrodollar. All right, this is all slow. This is well planned. It's being done in closed doors, but not between Washington and Beijing, but between Beijing and Moscow. I mean, the Chinese defense minister was just in Moscow this week for a security conference, he said specifically, and I quote, "We're here to show the Americans how close Russian and Chinese militaries are."
That's right.
That's a big statement.
It was huge.
That's as close as the Chinese, again, will ever come to saying, "We have our own Article 5, buddies."
Yeah. I mean, it was almost an epical event when they declared, it was three years ago, that there was a strategic partnership. And now that statement, it was essentially, look, you hit Article 5. You hit my friend over here, I hit you.
It does not. The multipolar world is returning, right? It is inevitable. We're in a great game now, not a Cold War.
Right.
It is a result of many things. It's a return of history when these big populous countries like China and India were once big players in the world stage, reduced because of Western imperialism and colonialism. They're back. Russia, they're back with a vengeance. It does not have to be. The emergence of a multipolar world does not have to be conflict, but those who have cannot give up to the money and power that they have willingly, even if the majority of it's being done by the system that they themselves, economic system, starting Bretton Woods all the way through, that they created.
You got to stop here, Mark. Thank you very much, and appreciate your time.
Thanks for having me, Don.
Yep. And that's all the news we have for you right now. For Community Public Radio, I'm Don DeBar in New York. Thanks for listening.
Hello and welcome to Crosstalk, where all things are considered. I'm Peter LeBeau. The continuing saga, how did three people in Salisbury survive contamination by a military-grade nerve agent? London has a lot of explaining to do. Also, Nikki Haley goes off the rails again. What exactly is a normal country? Crosstalking a world in crisis, I'm joined by my guest, Mark Sloboda. He's an international affairs and security analyst. We also have Victor Olevich. He is a political analyst as well as a leading expert at the Center for Actual Politics. And we have Dmitry Bobich. He is a political analyst with Sputnik International. Okay, gentlemen, as always, crosstalk rules in effect. That means you can jump in anytime you want, and I always appreciate it. Victor, let me go to you first here. Using the word saga is an understatement here. Bring us up to speed. What's going on with this alleged poisoning incident in the UK?
So what has happened this week? First of all, miraculously, all the so-called victims of this poisoning have come back to almost full health. Sergei Skripal is not only conscious now, not only did he come out of a coma, but he can speak. His daughter, Yulia,
military grade contamination.
His daughter, Yulia, is fine and well.
Military grade contamination.
She can speak on the phone. She is fine. And the thing is, the fact is that that type of chemical that they accused of Russia of somehow using against Skripal, if that would actually be used, they would never be able not only to come out of a coma, but they would not be alive today. Second of all, the British government denied a visa request from Sergei Skripal's niece to come and visit Sergei Skripal and his daughter in London.
Even though Yulia wanted it.
Yes, and one of the reasons given by the British authorities was that the cousin didn't have enough money. Maybe she would want to stay in Britain.
No, they don't ask that of Polish plumbers,
Of course,
they?
And on to top it off, to top it off, several hours ago, news came out that the United States is considering taking Sergei Skripal and Yulia Skripal to its witness protection program.
So an alleged crime happened in the UK, and they're getting witness protection in the United States.
In the U.S. And the reason,
what's going on here?
The reason given, the official reason given, is that the United States would be the best place to prevent further assassination attempts against Sergei Skripal.
I think that it's probably the best place. We'll never find out.
Exactly.
We will never hear from these people, Mark. Do we know that if Sergei and Yulia want to go to the United States, can they be compelled to go to the United States? Will we ever see them in front of a microphone? Will Yulia ever be able to visit her family in Russia again? So
just like Jeremy Corbyn, Peter, the only reason that you would question any of this is because that you are attacking the United Kingdom as part of the Russian spin machine. That is what the British Labour Party leader Jeremy Corbyn was accused of doing by the British Foreign Minister Boris Johnson.
So seeking the truth is not a priority here, Dima, right?
Well,
the truth is not of importance here.
I think basically you gave it the wrong name. What happened there was not poisoning. It was an attack against the United Kingdom by the Russian Federation with the use of chemical weapons. And Mark is right. You know, there is a joke making rounds in Russia. You know, Yulia Skripal was questioned by the British police if she noticed anything weird about, you know, before going to the UK. We know one of the versions that the poison was in that buckwheat that was brought to Skripal on his order from Russia. So, you know, the police asking, did you notice anything weird? She said, nothing special. Just when I went to buy this buckwheat in the nearby store, there was Putin in person selling it to me behind the counter. That was the only weird thing that I noticed. It was kind of strange.
No, they're actually.
But you know, it's we can make jokes about that, but the implications of this story are immense, and it is a lack of legitimacy in the British government to tell the truth.
There actually are victims in this saga.
Yes.
First of all, it's the pets. There's a cat that's dead. There's a guinea pig that belonged to Skripal that's dead. But the real victim is the relationship between Russia and the West. And the British authorities have obviously chosen a road of confrontation with Russia. They are going, they are willing to go the length to accuse Russia without any evidence, not presenting any evidence in the court in front of the international community.
So we're
and banking on Russophobia doing the job for them.
So we're foregoing the rule of law, the presumption of innocence before proven guilty, and we're foregoing the right to dissent. Mark.
Yeah, it has to be said that the pets died not because of some mysterious nerve agent, but because the British government killed
them.
Cremated them.
Exactly.
Right, for whatever
first
reason.
Starved them to death. Yeah.
So let's recover. Because we don't have a 15-minute memory here, let's recall that we were told that they were the British soil was attacked by a military-grade nerve agent, a secret Soviet military-grade nerve agent that just happened to be on a British spy drama earlier in the last year that is 10 times more powerful than VX. Military-grade. We were told the New York Times called it the nerve agent too deadly to use, right? The Telegraph said we should just let them die.
Everybody survives and comes back to life.
But all three victims come, right? But we have an explanation for this, because in Politico, Dan Cazzetta, who is purported to be a chemical weapon and security expert, he came up with all kinds of reasons why they could have survived. They could have been wearing gloves, all three of them. It could have been raining. It wasn't. Could have washed their hands afterwards. If magically the nerve agent just disappeared.
This technology is really awesome. So I can't kill, okay? Yeah.
But also, militaries.
Is a good match for washing your hands often.
The militaries create all different kinds and qualities of nerve agents. So not only did the Russian government commit an attack on a retired, old, swapped spy who had already served time in prison.
And had been squeezed by the FSB, had been squeezed by MI6. Right. See,
not only did they kill him with a super secret Soviet nerve agent that would point a glowing trail back to Russia, but they did it with a sub-lethal dose that let all three of them survive, too. This is what we are supposed to believe.
But you could just draw the conclusion that this was a publicity stunt to drive a certain agenda. Well, and many of those agendas are the failure of the May government to deal with Brexit, the failure of her own policies among the population as far as public opinion polls, and being able to use the tried and honored Russophobia that always trick.
We want to talk about a spin machine. Let's talk about the spin machine with Boris Johnson. All right, when
he's still foreign secretary?
He still is.
Really? How did that happen?
He lied to the public in the world and saying that it was certainly attributed to Russia by the Portsdown scientists, who then later contradicted this. That was not a lie, though. He misspoke. It was a mistake. He exaggerated slightly. It was an overstatement or a gaffe. Just take your choice. Yeah. That is a spin machine.
No, I'll take he's incompetent.
The problem was that
at the very least,
when Boris Johnson said that he knew that these weapons were made in Russia and that this was made on President Putin's order, he expressly referred to Downton Laboratory. He said that they told him.
The guy told him, right.
And it was simply just a brutal lie, I would say.
And then they had to delete that tweet.
Yes.
The foreign office deleted their own tweet to cover up what they said.
Also, what happened, when they destroyed the animals, when they didn't come to that house for several days because the guinea pigs died of starvation.
Well, you had a police officer standing next to the door for a number of days.
And he never
next
helped.
To the poisoned knob, apparently.
I don't know. If that is not tampering with the evidence, then what else is it?
Victor, are we ever going to find out what happened?
Other
than the official version,
everything
of course.
That is secret eventually becomes public knowledge, but when that eventuality will happen, is it 10 years from now? Is it 20 years from now? Is it 50 years from now? Is a big question. There's a little footnote to this. The British are actually saying they never used an antidote to the so-called Novichok.
So they came back
to life.
Here's the miracle.
From a coma.
You have to have a defined antidote.
Exactly.
Okay?
Exactly. Peter. That's why they're saying they didn't use the antidote, because in order to have an antidote, they would have to produce Novichok. Peter. And they're claiming they never had it.
Peter, we don't know what happened here, and we may never know. Right, because no real evidence. The only evidence we have is from the outrageous lies of the British government.
We don't even know that there was any poisoning.
The most credible story I have read, Moon of Alabama blog, says that the effects of seafood poisoning act very much like a nerve agent like this. Read it for yourself. It's at least more credible than the British government's version of what happened.
Well, I know what happened. Because I know what followed. The most important thing about the arson of Reichstag was not who personally, who was the person who set it on fire.
But who benefited.
The outcome, it basically brought Hitler unlimited power back in 1933. In the same way, I don't know exactly what happened in Salisbury. I know the consequences. I know how Russia now, when Russia convened a Security Council meeting of the United Nations, Britain complained that they didn't wait until the results of the investigation. Well, the UK went to the UN Security Council first, even before the police investigation. But in the sphere of public opinion, I think they already lost, because what happened was the rebirth of Soviet political jokes. Now, these jokes are not directed against the government in Moscow. They're directed against the government in America and in Britain. Let me just quote it. You know, the most hilarious one, the most recent one is, you know, Theresa May is reported to be raped in London. So they reported to Putin, and Putin says to the officer who said it, I have only one question. Am I the only suspect, or is it the whole Russian people?
Peter, 20 seconds. I think the Independent said it best in their editorial, the headline, whether we can prove Moscow's involvement in the Skripal case or not is irrelevant. The poisoning is severing Russians' relations with the West. I couldn't have said it better myself.
Okay, we're going to continue with this. We're going to go to a short break, gentlemen. After that short break, we'll continue our discussion on some real news. Stay with RT.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR.
Okay, gentlemen, I want to finish up on the first block here. You summed it up really well, Mark, at the end of the first part of the program. And I want to ask all three of you, where do we go from here, Mark?
They can't back down from this, right? If they back down from this, the British government would fall. And they can't let that happen, because that would likely mean Jeremy Corbyn's election. And that is what the British deep state and you know, the whole foreign policy elite fear most, is Jeremy Corbyn, the Labour Party leader, being elected. So they've got to get more outrageous with their lies. And I have a suggestion. The satirical website, The Postillion, headline, British police find Putin's passport at scene of Salisbury poison attack. And, I mean, considering the number of passports that terrorists and everyone else have left laying around scenes of crimes, why not?
Why not? Where do we go from here?
Mark is right. They can't and they will not back down. And one way for them to go forward is another, even more significant, even more dangerous provocation against Russia. So there may be another act that they blame on Russia, whether it's in the United States or in Great Britain. Remember Nikki Haley's words
during the Security
Council session, where she said, what happens if there is an attack in New York City? They may very well just organize something like that and then blame it on Russia with no evidence at all.
Well, they've proven you can get away with it.
Exactly.
The precedent.
Well, for me, the main problem, the main question is, how will Russia react?
Good.
Until now, Putin has always, in these embarrassing situations for them, he always left the door open for them. He always let them save face. You know, the lies about Iraq, Putin never raised it after the war, right? The attack on Yugoslavia, which was supposed to be justified by at least 100,000 Kosovo Albanians dead, you know, that turned out to be a lie. Yeah. They never found the graves, but Russia allowed them to save face and to get out with it. Now, I hope Russia will press on it, because, you know, just like they say, don't let Putin get away with it. Well, Putin has nothing to do with it. But now the question is, will Russia let them get away with it now? If it does, then it will continue. And it's not a problem of interstate relationship. It's a problem of ideological fight now. There is a very aggressive new ideology which unites the United States, the European Union, the UK. And unless it is countered now, it will get more and more
absurd.
That's
why I introduced this program as a world in crisis here. Nikki Haley's name has already been brought up here. I mean, I obviously like to make fun of her. You know, I've said many times that she has advanced degrees in hillbilly studies. I still believe that. But, you know, she had some very fiery words from a chief diplomat. It's quite scary. Russia will never be America's friend. Moscow can try to behave, quote unquote, like a regular country. But the U.S. will, quote, slap them when we need to. React to that, Victor. That's the chief diplomat from the United States going at the United Nations.
Two things here. First of all, what does she mean by be like a regular country?
Well, that's why I wanted to do this segment.
A regular country is a country that tiptoes to Washington, that follows...
Kowtows,
yes. That does what Uncle Sam essentially says, what it tells them to do, what it orders them to do, And says thank you.
Like the Netherlands. Russia should be more like the Netherlands.
And of course, Russia has its own domestic and foreign policy, just like China, just like Iran, just like Venezuela or Cuba. It is exactly these countries that have their own view of the world, that have their own foreign domestic policies, that want a friendship with America, but on their own terms, that irritate the American foreign policy establishment so much, from Nikki Haley to John Bolton to Mike Pompeo.
We'll
to
be
Donald
talking
Trump
a lot about John Bolton on this program here. But, you know, Mark, it's very interesting is that we have another round of sanctions came about. We have this whole affair in the UK. And we have Nikki Haley, we have John Bolton coming into play. This seems very well organized to me. And I think that what Dima had to say in the first part of the program is that, you know, now we have a precedent. Now we can see more of these shenanigans being played out to drive a specific agenda.
Yeah, and the latest is with these latest sanctions against Russian oligarchs and companies, as they call them, a handful that they say are close to Putin. First of all, Putin is probably just, and a lot of the Russian people, most of the Russian people, are just saying thank you. Thank you for pressuring and scaring our oligarchs, as such as it is, into repatriating their wealth back to the motherland rather than spending it in New York or London. I mean, we're really happy with that. But, you know, the most hilarious and ironic thing about all of this is that Russia's oligarchs, back in the day when they really existed, were created and celebrated by the Bill Clinton administration in Russia, right? That whole, we got Boris Yeltsin elected, you know.
It goes even further than machine, that.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So these latest sanctions really, again, are quite toothless. The intention is that they can force what they call oligarchs to overthrow Putin in a coup. This has been the liberal hope for years, knowing they can't win an election fairly.
So you keep trying a policy. That's right. You have liberals that can't win elections, and then you double down on policies that don't have any...
Why?
That do not come to fruition.
Because this is what the foreign policy experts on Russia in the West, who fundamentally misunderstand Russia...
You can put
Russia
all of those experts'
social
names
contract
on the back of a postage stamp.
Putin got rid of the oligarchs and leashed them to the power of the state. That's why there aren't any oligarchs per se, like, say, Jeff Bezos or
like Ukraine.
Or Mark Zuckerberg. Sheldon Adelson.
Dima.
I have a couple of points here. I think that basically this sanctions list that was published today, it is the most extensive in terms of effect, because the really rich people are included. You know, Vekselberg, the head of Renova company, which is huge. You know, Alek Deripaska, the head of Basel, which is just about all of Russia's metallurgy. But I think the mistake that they're making is that they basically spread this Kremlin list, sanctions list. They have spread it to almost 100% of Russia's rich people. So it looks like class struggle now. If you want to really sow discord between the Russian rich people, then take 50%, impose sanctions on them. Then maybe you will have a split. But the problem is that they impose sanctions on all of them. Why did they do it? Because the American foreign policy is actually fed by profoundly wrong information. There is no such science now as Russian studies. It is all fake. It's all ideologized. The idea that they have is that Russia is run by a bunch of capitalists, you know, tied to the president, and they have no base in society. That looks very much like the Russia of the 90s, which they liked and which they praised.
It doesn't look like
Russia today.
It looks very much like them. They're projecting.
In the worldview of the American elites, Russia was bad when it was a monarchy, Russia was bad when it was run by the Bolsheviks and the communists, and Russia is bad when it's run by capitalists. Mm-hmm. So the conclusion from this is that it doesn't matter who Russia is run by, but Russia itself is bad.
Russia was good when it was disintegrated.
When it was weak.
In 1917, it was good, Mark.
Is that, you know, the foreign policy elite in the West, they project all of their real sins projected upon Russia. Russia is, they say, you know, a normal country. What kind of normal country is in seven major conflicts around the world without any kind of international mandate, breaking international law on a regular basis.
With a thousand military bases.
The Americans don't consider themselves to be a normal country. They consider themselves to be an exceptional country. A single exceptional country, and all the rest must listen and abide.
The U.S. doesn't want Russia to be like them. God forbid, they want Russia to be like the Netherlands. Sorry, Netherlands.
Well, I think they want Russia to
leave
be,
them alone.
To be like Ukraine. Because
exactly.
Even
there's a better analogy.
Even in the Netherlands, last week you had the parliament castigating the anti-Russian propaganda group called EU versus Disinfo. For what? For attacking the Dutch media for publishing news from Russia, calling it fake news. The Dutch parliament rebelled, and they said that these people from the basically a government-financed EU versus Disinfo, that they have no right to pass a judgment on what the Dutch media is reporting, whether it's fake news or not. So Netherlands is too good, you know. Ukraine, or maybe Moldova, or maybe Poland. That would be the right way for Russia in their minds. But
Dima, they will. It's never going to happen.
Yes,
it's
true,
never going to happen. Why do they keep trying it?
Nikki Haley said, "Russia will never be America's friends, and we will have to slap them around when it's needed."
Mark, Victor, Dima, the United States.
That's what's going to happen.
The United States and Russia don't have to be friends.
Exactly.
They don't have to be friends, but they don't have to be enemies either. Okay.
Absolutely. Notice this.
Who cares about the term friends when you're talking about geopolitics? It's nonsense.
Throughout the years, even in Soviet times, even in the 70s, in the 60s, in the 80s, 90s, the 2000s, whether it's Putin or Brezhnev or Gorbachev or Andropov or Yeltsin, Russia has never, not a single Russian leader in the past 50 years has said that Russia does not want to be friends with America.
And that America
never,
is an enemy.
Never. No. Because in reality, Moscow wants to have a good relationship with America. Moscow doesn't want to have a confrontational relationship with Washington. A confrontation with Washington brings nothing good to Russia.
Or to the U.S., I would say.
Or to the United States. And one caveat to what Mark had said about the repatriation of resources of capital from Great Britain back to Russia. Of course, some resources are going to be repatriated to Russia or to other markets. But the British, throughout the last several decades, have shown themselves to be thieves.
The British establishment.
They knew very well who is investing those resources, who is putting that money in those banks. They knew it when those accounts were opened. They knew it when those investments of billions of dollars were made.
They wrote about it in their newspapers.
Yes. So it was not a surprise to them.
Not a mystery.
But now what they're going to do, they're not just going to allow all of it to be repatriated back to Russia. What they're going to do is they're going to seize these resources. And who knows how they're going to use them. Because we already have from the experience with Libya, and with Iraq, we know that billions of dollars that were in these accounts have simply disappeared.
It's an amazing racket. Hang on, let me give Dima the last 20 seconds of this part.
I think, their calculation that there would be a split in the Russian elite is wrong, and their calculation that the Russian poor people will rebel against their rich is also wrong. Nope. And let me just remind everyone, every time when people tried to confiscate all the property from the rich people in the UK, in Russia, it never made poor people happier. It never produced affluent countries.
On that point there, many thanks to my guests here in Moscow. This is the end of our broadcast segment. Stay with us for the extended version on our YouTube channel. See you next time, and remember, Crosstalk rules.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR, CommunityPublicRadio.org. I'm your host, Don DeBar.